which we stand. I acknowledge that you're holy. I acknowledge you as me. I trust you.
Welcome to the Pro-Life Team podcast. I'm here with Dr. Delgado, and today we're going to talk about his story with abortion pill reversal. Dr. Delgado, would you share a little bit about your backstory and then let's talk about your pro-life journey and discovery and APR and things that you might want to talk about beyond that are more current, as well.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on the podcast, first of all. I was really drawn to abortion pill reversal by a woman who was asking for help. I had studied mifepristone, previously known as RU486, and knew exactly how it works in causing chemical abortions. And I was rather intrigued by it. There was a lot of notoriety around it, as you may recall back before it was approved in the United States in the year 2000. And finally, when it was approved, then more and more women were using it to affect their abortions. And then in the year 2008, I got a phone call from a woman named Terry Palmquist, who is a sidewalk counselor in Bakersfield, California. But Terry isn't just an ordinary sidewalk counselor. She also has a website called Lifesavers and carries a cell phone. And has had a really long history in helping women in difficult times during pregnancies. And on that day, she had gotten a call from a woman in Texas who was interested in stopping her chemical abortion. She had taken mifepristone, had not taken the second drug in the cocktail, misoprostol, and had called Terry seeking help. Terry really didn't know how to help her. She had previously asked me for medical advice. So she called me and said, "Is there anything we can do for her?" I thought, well, Terry, I've never heard of this being done before, of stopping or reversing a chemical abortion, but let me think about it. So I gave it some thought, and I really think that it was the Holy Spirit who put two things together in my mind. One was my knowledge of mifepristone and how it works by blocking progesterone receptors. And the other was my knowledge of using progesterone in pregnancy for women who had low progesterone levels and had situations we call threatened miscarriages, where they're cramping and spotting, and they look like they might be going towards a miscarriage. But if we replace those low progesterone levels and bring them up closer to normal, we often are able to save those babies. So I thought to myself, well, perhaps, although these women may not have low progesterone levels, their progesterone is certainly deficient because it's being blocked by the mifepristone. So perhaps I thought we could give supplemental progesterone to outcompete the mifepristone at the receptor site. And the analogy I often use is to think about the progesterone being a key, and a key is inserted into a keyhole. It turns the lock, and then a door opens. Well, that's exactly the way hormones, keys, the receptors, the locks, and then the hormone effect, the door opening, work. So the progesterone causes a hormone effect, which is a good effect in the mother, which allows the pregnancy to continue. Well, all of us have had the experience of putting a key into a lock that fit into the lock but didn't turn the lock. We might turn that a false key. That's exactly what mifepristone is in this analogy. It's a false key. It goes on the receptor, but it does not activate the receptor. So that door is never opened. We never get the hormone effect. Fortunately, the mifepristone falski goes in and out of the lock. It's a dynamic situation. And so I theorize that if we had more of the good guy keys lined up there, higher progesterone levels, then when the mifepristone came off the receptor, the odds of a good guy key, the progesterone going on that receptor, would be higher. And we could then outcompete the mifepristone until the mifepristone washed out of the body. So with that idea that came to me, I had to overcome a second hurdle. And that was that the patient was in Texas and I was in San Diego. So I got on the phone and I found Dr. Jonalyn Bellacura, who is in El Paso, Texas. And she had had experience using progesterone in pregnancy like I had. And she agreed to use the protocol that I drew up essentially there on the fly. And Terry got the patient in contact with Dr. Bellacura. Dr. Bellacura treated the patient. And within a few weeks, I got a good report from Dr. Bellacura. The baby was still alive. And then updates thereafter through the pregnancy. And I was very, very grateful to hear that the baby had survived and the mother gave birth to a very healthy baby. Now, it was later on when I was assembling cases to write my first article in the peer-reviewed literature that I found a case that actually had preceded my case. That was Dr. Matthew Harrison about a year and a half, 2 years earlier in North Carolina. And he had had a very similar experience where a woman came to him saying that she had taken mifepristone and wanted to stop her abortion. And he did a very similar treatment that I had offered, and that was giving progesterone, and that baby survived too.
Wow. So, and that was in, so 2008, and I guess the other gentleman was 2006 then.
This was in 2006.
So tell us, how things have gone since that beginning. How are things gone over these last 18, 19 years?
Well, from there, after that first case, I really didn't know if I had made a difference or not, because this could have, we're trained as scientists and we know not to make conclusions just based on one case. And so I still didn't know if the progesterone had saved that baby or not, but I certainly thought that this was very interesting. Then as time went on, more people started calling, they heard about my case and they started calling, asking me for advice. What did you do? What should I do? And I would tell them what exactly I did. And then before we knew it, we had a number of cases that we were aware of. And that's when I wrote the first article in the peer-reviewed literature in 2012, describing six different cases. At that point, I thought, well, gosh, I think we're probably really onto something, because all these cases were very, very similar in many respects. And the babies were saved. The babies did very well. Four out of six of the cases we reported had successful births. And then more and more people were calling and learning about this. And I knew then that we had to do something a little differently, because each case was a one-off. We would get a call. I would scramble around and try to find somebody in that part of the country to treat the patient. We were wasting a lot of time. And we also were hearing of cases of women who hadn't heard of us until it was too late. And they wished they had known about the possibility of reversing their chemical abortions. So it was in 2012, after publishing that article, that I started the Abortion Pill Reversal Network. And that consisted of a hotline as well as a website. And the website served a couple of functions. One was to let women know about the possibility of abortion pill reversal. Two, it gave them a lot of information they could read right there on the website. And then it connected them to the hotline, which would allow them to interact with us, so that we could connect them with a doctor in the area where they lived. In conjunction with starting that, the website and the hotline also started the network of physicians and clinics who were willing and able and very competent to treat these women. And so slowly but surely started building that network. And from that point, really the growth was pretty organic, and the network grew slowly but surely and very steadily over time, until finally, by 2018, we published our second article, and this one described over 500 women who had attempted reversal. And we have very good data on that and published that in another peer-reviewed journal. At that point, all the financial support for this endeavor had come from the San Diego nonprofit where I have my medical practice. It's called Culture of Life Family Services. And we got to a point where we tried to do some national fundraising, but it's very, very difficult to get started with that. So the now international project was really outgrowing its limited local nonprofit sponsor. So we had been in some discussions with the people at Heartbeat International. I had known Joel Godsey and some others there. And they were very interested in taking over the network. And we knew that they had a lot of institutional depth. They were an international organization. They already had a hotline running. So we transferred the website, the hotline, and the network to them, selling it for a dollar in 2018. And they took it over and have grown it very well since and have done a wonderful job of nurturing and growing it. Now, they at that time knew that their competence wasn't in scientific studies or in designing medical protocols. So they wanted that to stay with me. And I agreed to keep that. The Culture of Life Family Services wasn't so interested in that because that was kind of outside of the mission of the local organization. So that's when I started Steno Institute, which is a nonprofit dedicated to increasing awareness, education, and research around abortion pill reversal.
Wow. I remember when I first heard you speak, it was at Sister Paula's Internationalized Services Advanced Training Institute. And that might have been in the year 2010, 11. I'm not quite sure, I guess, now, but a long time ago. And I think you shared there before you shared at a heart. I remember also you shared at a Heartbeat conference, like CareNet conference a few years later, or maybe 2 years later, or maybe a year and a half. It's also a long time ago. But I remember the first time I heard you share about APR, I didn't understand. Like, even though I sat there, I heard it, it didn't click that, oh, wow, you can reverse a medical abortion. Like, it was just something that was, I wasn't ready to hear, I suppose, but eventually after a few months after hearing you talk, it clicked. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. And I just got real excited. But have you had anyone else with that experience where you tell them about this discovery and it takes them a while to understand like what you're really, you know, what this really is?
Well, I haven't really had the opportunity to follow up like I have with you about when it clicked. But I do know that, you know, it is kind of a novel concept. And for some people, even understanding the whole process of the chemical abortion, it takes a while for them to understand that. So a lot of times people get it confused with the morning after pill, which is very different. So yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if it did take a while for all this to really click, to make sense, because it is, you know, rather different from other things they've heard and learned about.
Interesting. So this podcast is made up of a great deal of pregnancy clinic, in the audience, is made up of several pregnancy clinic directors, pro-life friends. What would you want them to hear about where APR is today, or what would you say that would be encouraging to them based on, like, how would you want them to, what would you want them to know about APR, or how would you encourage them to increase awareness about APR, or whatever the current biggest need might be is?
I think probably the biggest need is the realization that they need to know as much as possible about APR and to support and foster APR in their areas. Because I truly believe that APR is really becoming the tip of the spear of the pro-life movement. Why do I say that? It's because right now, chemical abortions make up probably 70% or more of all abortions in the United States. And so it's where, you could say, it's where the action is. And unfortunately, women are being victimized more and more by telehealth and mail order abortions, where they're not even meeting person to person with someone who can explain things. They're going online, and after a very simple medical interaction, or after just typing into a mail order website, where, you know, I've gone in and it took me as few as 10 as 6 steps to get to the point where I could purchase mifepristone. So more and more women are going to be purchasing this online, getting it through the mail with much less medical supervision. And I think that those women who are doing this are not going to have as much chance to reflect as they would have if they had to drive to an abortion center and meet face-to-face, even though that person is pro-abortion. It's still meeting with the person. It's still looking at someone's face in person. It still gives a chance for self-reflection. Waiting in a waiting room. I'll diverge a little bit. I have a book coming out in October called Abortion Pill Reversal, Second Chance at Choice, and it's for the general public. It'll be published by Ignatius Press. And in there, a part of the book is first-person accounts of women who've gone through mifepristone abortions and then reversals. So these are APR patients who give their stories. And a common theme is the time in the waiting room where they're reflecting. The time waiting, they're reflecting. So if they just do it boom, boom, boom online, and then it comes in the mail, there's much less chance for reflection. Because in the interim, when the thing is coming in the mail, they're often doing their own thing. They're back to their usual lives. They're not waiting and waiting, waiting, thinking about it. Whereas in that clinic, they don't have anything else to do, so they're thinking about it. So I think women will maybe be making more hasty decisions. When they make more hasty decisions, they may be more likely to think about reversal. So that's why I think that abortion pill reversal is so important. It really, really, I think, is cutting edge of the pro-life movement. It is really the CPR for the pre-born baby. When you think about how important CPR is, and this is how important that abortion pill reversal is for the pro-life movement, for those women who are being victimized by the medical abortion complex.
Yeah. And when you were previously talking about how APR works, or how mifepristone works when it comes to being like a key that goes in, but then it will come back out and then go back in the block. It makes sense that you would, yeah, everything you're saying just makes so much sense. And it's good to hear it again, as someone who's, you know, comes from a different background than medical, perhaps. But it's helpful to try and visualize that key concept and how that provides the opportunity for a good connection to be made and for the mifepristone to be washed out. That makes a lot of sense. So when it comes to the different ways in which in which APR has been provided to a woman, how is that reflected in the numbers of like percents? You know, and the success rates, or what different types have been, tried, and what are some of the outcomes of those different methods?
Well, our second study showed that what we call the high dose oral protocol looked like it was the most effective, or about equally effective to progesterone injections, and because injections are difficult, they can be painful, and sometimes it's hard to get that form of progesterone. We have been mostly encouraging high-dose oral progesterone, and that means the basic protocol from that study is 400 milligrams twice a day for 3 days, and then 400 milligrams at night until the end of the first trimester. However, since then, I've kind of increased the dose based on experiences here in the United States, and especially in Switzerland. In Switzerland, they use a higher dose of mifepristone itself. And so there, the doctors are accustomed to using even higher doses of progesterone. The women have very much tolerated it very well. And thus far, it appears that those higher doses probably are even better than the high dose protocol. And I'm talking about 600 milligrams twice a day for a few days, and then 400 milligrams twice a day. With the progesterone by mouth, it's important that the woman take it with food because it gets better absorbed. Now, in other areas of reproductive medicine, vaginal progesterone has sort of had a favored place as a route of administration, where a woman takes the capsule and inserts it into her vagina. And the reason for that is that when it goes that way, it's absorbed directly into the blood. It doesn't go to the liver first. And when any medicine goes by mouth, it first goes to the liver, and the liver breaks it down. And so we call that the first pass effect. Well, when you give a medicine another way, by injection or vaginally, or sometimes we even give medicines rectally, it bypasses the liver so that the medicine can get first to where it needs to go, and then later on trickle over to the liver. However, it was interesting in our second study, we did not see a big advantage to vaginal progesterone. So that's why we haven't been recommending it. But because of its use in other areas like in infertility, where it does seem to work better vaginally, in the future, we certainly want to have a study that's going to compare vaginal with oral and to kind of settle that question once and for all. So that's something that's on the horizon that we're in the planning stages. But until then, this is where we are.
So based on this experience of this, you know, being part of this, you know, discovering APR and then working with this, you know, growing the network and, you know, literally helping save thousands of lives. Where have you seen God's fingerprints in this journey, and how has God supported you in this work, or where has God, you know, protected you in this work?
Well, God's fingerprints are all over it. First of all, it's totally obvious. Just my professional path, no doubt that God influenced it. My choice of specialty of family medicine, including obstetrical care, delivering babies earlier on in my career. And then I had a real conversion in my life, which was about 31, 32 years ago, where I really decided that it was time for me to live totally, thoroughly, and only for God, and to do everything according to His will. And so that kind of reconversion in my life led to changing my medical practice, where I kind of started to see my practice as a ministry. I stopped prescribing contraceptives, and I took a training in NAPRO technology under Dr. Thomas Hilgers in Omaha, Nebraska, who has a St. Paul the Sixth Institute, where he teaches doctors and other medical practitioners how to approach problems in women and men's reproductive systems following the natural design that God intended without circumventing, destroying, or replacing the natural reproductive system. And that's where I learned how to use progesterone in situations of threatened miscarriage. If I hadn't had that, I would have treated a threatened miscarriage the same way most doctors do, which is to say, well, there's nothing we can do. Let's just wait and watch. And instead, this is a way to proactively help. And it's been shown to be effective in studies. So if God led me to that first, and so I had that first part, that knowledge bank I talked about earlier in my brain about how progesterone works and how to use it in women with low progesterone levels. And then he led me to have this interest in mifepristone, which, of course, is something that is a tool of the culture of death, but for some reason fascinated me, not because I wanted to use it, of course, but I just was very intrigued on how it worked. I didn't know why I was interested in it, but every time any article I saw about it came out, you know, pre-2000, before it was approved, I was reading about it, and I knew about it, and I knew about the kind of the political tug-of-war that happened before it got approved in different countries and in the U.S., and finally when it was approved in 2000. So I was kind of, God had primed me and had me ready to go so that I knew about how mifepristone worked. I knew how progesterone worked in pregnancy. I never thought about how those two would interact. It was only until that moment when I got the call from Terry Palmquist, and there God again gave me the big nudge and turned on the light bulb in my brain and said, hey, you can use this to fix this. And so, and it all made perfect sense. And so I went with it, and I went with faith, you know, going out and calling Dr. John Olin Bellicrew, whom I didn't know, telling her something that she might have considered a crazy proposition. But God touched her too, and she said, sure, I'll go along with it. I'll do what you're saying. And God also obviously put Terry Palmquist in the equation to bring us together. And then from there on, I really saw that really with every instance, God's finger was in it. And when we were trying to find somebody, you know, somewhere else across the country, there was one in Boston, Massachusetts, and the only doctor I could find was a resident, Dr. Jeremy Calamadridis, who's now in Austin, Texas, at the Vitae Center. And there, he was a resident. And residents, you know, have to be very careful, especially in OBGYN residencies, as they can get kicked out at any time and lose their ability to train in their specialty. he took the chance of treating a patient there and, while he was a resident. And that was a wonderful case. So there are people like that who God touched. God brought all sorts of people into the situation. Volunteers here at Culture of Life Family Services were very dedicated and who used their skill sets to advance the network. And then all the great pro-life doctors who've helped promote it, God's touched them. Dr. Matthew Harrison, he's been so faithful, and he's now on the board of Steno Institute, as well as Dr. Mary Davenport, who's on the board too, who wrote co-authored the first article with me and wrote a great article in 2017 looking at the survival rate of babies who are only exposed to mifepristone and if nothing else is done. Dr. Bill Lyle in Florida calls himself Pro-Life Doc and has prolifedoc.com, and he goes around giving talks, and he's been a great ambassador for abortion pill reversal. All the great godly people at Heartbeat International who've really nurtured this. So it's just been one thing after another of great people being brought together by God, really in order to give him glory and to help not just protect preborn babies and to save their lives, but really, I think, in some ways, more importantly, to save the spiritual lives of these women who are choosing to reverse their chemical abortions. And the stories in the book are just great. I mean, these stories, you couldn't make them up. The moments of grace that are in these women's lives that get them to really go to be from one who is trying to abort her baby and just an instant now becomes the savior of her baby. So it's really such a transformation. I really see abortion pill reversal as a metaphor for many things in life, metaphor for second chances, metaphor for transformation, metaphor for salvation.
Yeah, it's and what is the percent chance, you know, based on that very first APR that was done, what do you think the percent chance of, well, it feels like God's hand was on that one, because if that one wasn't successful, you know, pursuing this further would have been just a very different story. And the fact that it was successful just shows, yeah, it seems to reflect, yeah, God's favor so much on this direction. Can you reflect on that? Like the idea that very first one was successful and how, you know, how that reflects where God was driving this idea.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. I've never thought of it that way, but it does make perfect sense. Now that I reflect on it, if that first case had been unsuccessful, I don't know if I really would have had the courage to try it again, because, you know, you're putting yourself out there when you try something that's brand new, that's novel. I certainly have been criticized extensively and persecuted. So I didn't know how much persecution I would face at that first case, but I know that just my integrity as a physician is always to do my best to offer things that I think have a reasonable hope for success and that are, you know, backed by science. So that first case, if it had failed, I might not have had the courage to go on. So you're right. I think that itself was God's hand in pushing me forward, giving me the courage I needed, me, a weak, ordinary physician, in order to take me as an ordinary person to do extraordinary things.
And so speaking of, like, you know, well, the need for the armor of God and just the attacks that would come with, so my son said something really wise once. He said, you know, a robber doesn't try and rob an empty bank, you know, or the enemy doesn't try and rob an empty bank. And so the fact that you're having success in this area and really cutting the legs out of, well, working to cut the legs out of the, you know, the enemy's abortion pill industry, it reflects how much impact you had. And that's why they were going after you or other people that are successful in the pro-life work with such veracity. How has God protected you and supported you through, you know, through this war or these battles where they would go after you because you were being successful in reversing the abortion pill?
Well, God has been extremely kind and nurturing and protective. There's no doubt. I feel his presence just very, very close to me. And I've been very blessed to have I'm Catholic, and I've had I've been blessed to have the opportunity to just about every day to go to daily mass and to receive him in the Eucharist. And receiving his body and blood is what strengthens me and gives me the courage to go on, and sort of keeps the enemies at check at every corner. I am absolutely positive that corners I never even realized were there, and people lurking behind in shadows that I never knew were there. And because of God's grace and his protection, I never really had to confront them. And other times when I've been confronted head on, he's given me a great peace. He's given me direction. He's given me words to say when I've been deposed, or when I've given testimony, or when I've done podcasts. It's always been he given me the right words at the right time, and the right amount of courage at the right time, the right amount of insight when it was time to start the network, when it was time to write the book. And other times, keeping my own ideas and ambitions tamped down when maybe they would have gotten in the way. So maybe when I would have done something, maybe it would have been a good thing, but it wasn't the right time, wasn't God's time. He's put a lid on those, and that's been a good grace too, because we as humans don't have the prudence that God has, and we need to really always try to discern his will and do his will, always in the proper time. And I think I haven't been perfect at it, and certainly any missteps and mistakes are fully my responsibility. But any of the successes and the victories we've had and the savings of lives, those all that glory and credit goes to God for sure.
I think it was a few weeks ago when I heard Heartbeat International announced that APR had saved its 7,000th baby. And being that was a few weeks ago, it's probably a higher number now. But yeah, it's definitely growing. Mm-hmm. And I know that, you know, for a long time, it was a matter of getting pregnancy clinic directors to be aware that this existed. I think today it's probably for people to be aware in general, for the general public to be aware when they happen to be, you know, for those who are seeking to end their pregnancy with the abortion pill, for them to know that there is an option to reverse it, for that awareness to be built, I think is probably one of the current goal lines I would expect still.
Yes, you're absolutely right, because we want them to know ahead of time before they've even taken mifepristone. Hopefully, you know, with God's grace, they won't even take it. But if they do, that idea is already in their head that they have the opportunity for reversal. But it's also people who might be mentors to those women. So we want anybody else who might be in that woman's sphere of influence to know about abortion pill reversal, because she'll call out to somebody. She'll call her sister, call her mother, call her friend, whoever it is. And we want it so that all those people already know about abortion pill reversal. One of the stories in the book is exactly like that, where someone called for help, and that person knew about abortion pill reversal already and told her. So all those people in the sphere of influence, we want them. We also want people who are influential, who can help turn the tide. Because right now, you know, the lies and the misstatements being spread by the medical abortion complex are huge, and people respect them. People respect the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. They don't know the backstory as to why they're so heavy into promoting abortion, and that they've never polled their membership to see how they should, what their stance should be on abortion. It's all been a top-down thing. And so, but they still carry a lot of influence among not just amongst doctors, but in people in general, and amongst lawmakers. In about a week and a half, I'm going to be speaking at the Live Action Lawmakers Conference, where I'll be speaking to about 100 different state lawmakers and trying to educate them on abortion pill reversal so they can pass laws that can protect women from interstate commerce, from these predatory mail order and telemedicine abortions, even in pro-life states. So we want to end that. We also want, in states that do allow abortion, we want them to be required to tell them about the possibility of abortion pill reversal, because right now they're lying to them. We've had many, many cases of women who've told us that after taking the mifepristone, they've changed their minds. The first thing is they call the abortion center. My wife says that they're kind of like homing pigeons. They go back to where they know, where it's familiar. They call the abortion center and they've been told lies. They tell them that no, reversal is not possible. Reversal is ineffective. That your baby is sure to have birth defects. So they're lying, because we've proven that there's no increased risk of birth defects with abortion pill reversal. One anecdote was especially chilling, where a woman called and she was told that you have to finish what you started. If you don't, it would be like if you shot your dog and watched him die. And so these are just cruel, untrue comments that they're getting. And so we want to educate everybody who might have contact with these women. And we also want to educate the people in these pro-abortion, in these clinics, in these abortion centers. We actually have heard one anecdote where a woman was told by the abortion center worker that yes, she could reverse her chemical abortion. And so there even is some light there in that huge den of darkness.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot to think about. The pills being shipped overnight, or groups who have like collected large amounts or stockpiled the abortion pill, you know, because of concern over it maybe not being available someday, and then now they're like turning into like drug distributors to people who may live on that same college campus, or who live in that area for her friends or his friends or whoever's friends. And all the unknowns about where these drugs come from, all the unknowns about getting them from, well, places where people don't normally get prescriptions, and then just people taking it into their own hands, like do it yourself style versus talking to a medical professional. It seems like things, and like I've heard numbers anywhere from 60 to 64%, 70%, even as high as 80% of abortions are with the pill. And mostly that's from executive directors in different parts of the country. They'll say anywhere between 60 to 80%.
It's at least 63%, because the last Guttmacher study, which is now about 3 years old, said 63%. So I think it's north of that. And I would say it's safe to say 70%.
Yeah, and that's a huge majority of abortions. And I'm not sure of what the percent is of people that are doing it, do it yourself, ordering it over the internet without any, really without informed consent, without being truly, without understanding what the repercussions, what the risks are, what to do if something negative happens, really being uninformed, but yet consenting to something that's very risky. And then what are your thoughts on that number that came out recently, where it used to be 0.5% of major issues according to the FDA, and now it's been released that it's about 11.something% of those who take the abortion pill have a major issue?
Those data are very good, and they're consistent with a study done in Finland going back now about 10 years, where they compared the short-term complications of chemical abortion versus surgical complication. And there they had excellent data, because Finland is a country with socialized medicine. So everything you do medically is entered into a computer, and all their computer databases are interactive. And so it's very easy to track all that. And they found, that the risks of are, in the order of about 10 to 12%, and that the chemical abortions have 4 to 5 times the risk of surgical abortions. So there's no doubt about that. And those risks are very consistent with what was seen in the U.S. study. The U.S. study was a very good study. They took all a large database of insurance claim data. And so they did a very, very good job with that. And the problem was with the label of the mifepristone, which showed the 0.5%, is that if you look deeply in the data that they have this data already, but they kind of spun it and they only, in the kind of the bottom line description, only put that 0.5%. And so it was very misleading. And so this study has been very important to bring to light what the true risks are so that women can really know that that these are lies. They're saying the lies include the lies that it's more dangerous than Tylenol and all of this nonsense. And that of course, they take numbers. They took numbers on Tylenol overdoses, which is an intentional misuse of Tylenol, and compared it with the side effects with the intentional proper use of mifepristone. So that's comparing apples to oranges. The proper comparison, if you wanted to go that route, would be to take what's the risks of overdose with Tylenol with overdose with mifepristone. That is, if you take a huge dose of mifepristone, you're comparing that. But that's not the comparison they made. They should take a comparison of side effects of regular, a proper use of Tylenol with the regular use of mifepristone. So the lies and the spin abound, and we see it all the time. That's why we have to be very proactive at getting the truth out. And that's why we have to be very disciplined and only reporting what we find and not using exaggeration or hyperbole like they do. And I truly think that the people in the middle are very convincible. They're open-minded people. They're reasonable people. The people who are pro-life, of course, they've already seen it and they accept that abortion pill reversal is a good thing, and they see the dangers and the risks of mail order and telehealth abortion. While those who are very ideologically linked to abortion, whether it's because they've had abortion themselves or because they profit from it or whatever, or they profit academically from studying it, they will be very difficult to convince and maybe impossible to convince. But we still want to do our best with them.
Hmm. Can you speak about the connection with ectopic and how, you know, the symptoms of ectopic match those that of for someone taking the abortion pill?
Yeah. So ectopic pregnancy is when the embryonic person, instead of latching onto the wall of the uterus, implants before getting down there, implants usually in the fallopian tube about 95% of the time. But there are other places where you can have an ectopic pregnancy, including in the cervix. In other words, going too far, overshooting your target, or actually going out into the abdomen, but 95% of the time in the fallopian tube. And that happens probably around 0.5 to 1.5% of all pregnancies, depending on which study you look at, maybe even up to 2%. And when the preborn baby is in the tube and starts to grow and expand like he or she should, well, the tube is not designed to hold that pregnancy, and the tube then eventually will rupture, and the mother can bleed to death. It's a very, very dangerous situation. And we're fortunate now because of vigilance that the risk of a mother dying from that is much lower than it used to be because of our modern medical treatments and our increased vigilance. Well, if a woman procures a telehealth or a mail order abortion, she generally will not have an ultrasound. An ultrasound is critical, not just for dating, but also to confirm that the preborn baby is in the uterus, is in the proper place. And mifepristone abortion is not approved to treat ectopic pregnancies. It's not very successful at that. And if a woman assumes she has an intrauterine pregnancy and has not had an ultrasound to prove otherwise, well, if she takes that mifepristone and starts to bleed, she may assume that that bleeding is simply from the chemical abortion. If actually her tube has started to rupture and she's bleeding from that, she's going to ignore the signs and she won't go seek emergency medical help like she would have otherwise if she didn't know, if she didn't assume her pregnancy was in the uterus. And I believe we will see women dying on their bathroom floors on the altar of choice because they've been misled and because they haven't had ultrasounds to determine if they have ectopic pregnancies or not. So that's going to be a very, very big risk that we will see women dying from this. The other medical risk that is going to be a big one is that 15% of the population has a blood type of Rh negative. And if you're a woman, you're Rh negative, and you have a preborn baby who's Rh positive, during the pregnancy and at delivery, when the blood mixes, the mother gets exposed to Rh positive cells and she'll start an immune response. And that's the reason why we test women for Rh factor and we give them a shot if they're Rh negative, and that's to blanket or hide any Rh positive red blood cells so they don't get sensitized. Well, up until very recently, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists recommended that women having abortions get Rh tested and get treated if they're Rh negative, because during an abortion, blood can mix and the mother can get sensitized. It was very interesting with the COVID pandemic used as a guise for deregulating chemical abortions and now allowing the telehealth and mail order chemical abortions. Well, women aren't tested for Rh. And so now the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists says that, well, you really don't need to test for Rh with abortions. And they based that on a study of only about 200 women. And you could read about this in my book, that basically it was ideologically driven. And in their statement, they even said that they may not have enough data to be conclusive about this, but they went ahead and they made that recommendation. You do not have to check Rh. And so 15% of the women who are Rh negative and undergo these chemical abortions without having been Rh tested, well, if they have Rh positive babies, then they will be sensitized, and then future wanted pregnancies will be at peril because they will mount greater and greater immune response with future pregnancies with Rh positive babies, and that will doom them to stillbirths and to preborn babies with congestive heart failure, all sorts of problems that may even effectively render them infertile in terms of not being able to take babies to term and have healthy babies. So a great tragedy is in the making.
Mm. And what's the name of your book, and when is it scheduled to be available, or what's the plan for that?
The title is Abortion Pill Reversal, A Second Chance at Choice. And again, it's written for the general public, so it's not a medical textbook at all. And it'll be released in October by Ignatius Press.
Awesome. Yeah, looking forward to that. That'll be good to get a copy of that. Well, Dr. Delgado, I've really enjoyed having you on here and for you to share just so much wisdom and insight. As we wrap things up, would you want to share any final thoughts? And then would you close us in prayer with the expectation that those who are listening will join as they're listening to this podcast and the prayer you lead?
Sure, I'd be honored to. I think the final choices are just to keep in mind that chemical abortion is increasing, will increase even more in our country, I'm sure. And that we want to make sure that women know that if they change their mind, there is a second chance at choice. We want to be there for them. We want to love the preborn baby and love the mother and give the mother all the support she needs so that she can carry out her life in a good, wholesome, and holy way. So now we can close in prayer. Good and loving Father, we thank you for this time together with Jacob in order to discuss the life-giving gift that you've given to us called abortion pill reversal. Thank you for our opportunity to spread knowledge about it, for increasing awareness, education, and research about it. And we ask, Lord, that you touch the hearts of those who have been opposed to abortion pill reversal, who are persecuting us. Touch the hearts of those women who are considering abortion. Let them choose life. And for those who have already chosen mifepristone, Lord, please give them a very fast touch of the heart so that they can know and find out and choose abortion pill reversal. Choose to save their lives so that you can help them save their own spiritual lives and come under your good graces. And we ask that you bless all those people in the pro-life movement who are so giving, who are such heroes, who are so selfless, Lord. Please inspire them all. Please bless all those at Steno Institute, Heartbeat International. Bless Jacob and his apostolate. Help us all to be your faithful, humble, and obedient servants. We ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.